Hello, everybody. Welcome back to North Idaho Now. This is episode 56 for August 13th. Chance Watson and Madison Hardy bringing you the news today. And this episode is brought to you by Hecla Mining Company. Hecla Mining Company is a leading low-cost silver producer with operating silver mines in Alaska, Idaho, and Mexico, and is a growing gold producer with operating mines in Quebec, Canada, and Nevada. They are the largest primary silver producer in the U.S., responsible for one-third of the silver produced in our nation. Their philosophy is to operate mines safely by promoting a deeply rooted value-based culture, leveraging mining skills developed over the company's long history, and by innovating new practices. To learn more about Hecla Mining Company, please visit heclamining.com. I've actually been... post it. Did you time me?
Yeah.
23 seconds? Not bad. It's pretty good. All right. That's the mark. I'll see if I can go faster next time. So I actually have been posting. Every time I post this, I always throw like, thanks to our advertisers. And I've been trying to tag Hecla, and I always tag them, but then like the tag doesn't, it, like, goes away on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that Hecla, they don't go by Hecla Mining Company. They go by Hecla Nevada, because that's like where their, one of their mines is.
Oh.
Yeah, so
interesting.
They shared our stuff, which, thank you, Hecla, appreciate it. But yeah, it was like the first time, and they've been a sponsor for a while.
Peace, love, Hecla.
Uh-huh.
All
They've been doing pretty good lately with everybody's hiring, but it seems like everybody is hiring.
I think everyone is hiring, honestly.
It seems like it. Between that and dealing with smoke and dealing with COVID stuff.
Yeah, everything's going great.
It seems, yeah, everything's going great. Madison, how are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I feel good. I went to the gym this morning.
Yes, you were just bragging about that before we started recording.
I wasn't bragging. I was just saying, like, I feel good.
I think most of the things that you say are brags.
They're not. I promise they're not. Make me sound like I'm so full of myself. I'm decent at best. Like, in just in overall terms of a person. Like B minus, B plus. Depending
fishing.
On the day.
You're fishing.
Never, right. Never an A. No, that's not a thing.
I'm not fishing.
I did go fishing recently, though. Like, actual literal fishing.
Where'd you go?
Coeur d'Alene River. Near, locals will know it. It's CCC. It's near a Mennonite area.
I think you were telling me that.
Yeah. Place. I caught a water bottle. Like a really nice hydro flask.
No, someone lost their hydro flask.
Like, it's a really nice hydro flask with like Save the Elephant stickers on it.
Did you keep it?
I have it. Yeah. So if somebody listens to this podcast and knows who it is, you can tell me all the stickers on it and I'll give it back to you.
Got to get the verification.
Some of them fell off because it was completely submerged in water, but I grabbed them.
All right, listeners, let's see if we can find the Save the Elephants water bottle owner.
It's like Free the Elephants, Save the Elephants, something like that. There was an apple sticker on there too.
Oh.
And it's like blue, powder blue almost.
Oh, pretty.
It's like a light blue, yeah.
It's like a silver blue.
It's not, granted, I'm not an expert on quality of water bottles, but it seems like it's, I mean, if it's Hydro Flask, that's got to be nice, right?
Oh, gosh, if it's not, then what are we paying our money for?
I don't know, though, because there's a lot of those, you know, like a lot nowadays, people are forking over a lot of money for, you know,
brands.
You know, when I was a young boy, you had these coolers that were basically like plastic.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, they were basically glorified toys because they were just plastic that had a plastic lid and that was it.
Yeah.
Or maybe you had, you know, if you were real desperate, you had one of those styrofoam ones that I can't stand because styrofoam squeaking is like my kryptonite. Oh, if I was being tortured, they could hit me and stuff, but then they'd be like, "Oh, we're gonna rub the styrofoam together." Okay, I'll tell you everything. I can't.
Well, now that everyone knows that, we all.
Well,
know
I'm not planning on getting tortured anytime soon.
We will find out next time.
I don't have any state secrets. but yeah, nowadays they've got like Yeti coolers, mm-hmm. and all that stuff that, like, they look like they could survive an explosion, which I guess is good, but to me seems like a little bit overkill.
As a Hydro Flask owner, it cannot survive an explosion. I actually dropped it at the gym the other day, and I picked it up, and there was a little small dent in it, and I was like, oh, I'm stupid.
I mean, it still works, though.
of course that still works. I mean, granted, the plastic water bottles... Because I know exactly what you mean. I used to have one of those plastic water bottles that you got from, like, Walmart or Winco that was just a basic water bottle.
Yeah. Like, water bottle brand water bottle.
Yeah. Like, plastic
brand one. Yeah, totally, yeah.
But they probably last a little bit better than some of those. But some of the hard plastic water bottles do just fine. They just don't keep it cool.
I guess so.
I think that's really the defining
big thing
factor.
Is like the insulation on it. Yeah, okay. I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, that's probably where all your money's going then. Keep things cold. But I mean, but who wants to keep some people. I was just about to say, who wants to keep like all like their sodas and their beers and their waters and, you know, their camping food, you know, like keep that on ice for 2-3 weeks. I guess some people do.
I don't know anyone that keeps anything in a Yeti cooler for 2-3 weeks.
That's true. I mean, you know, maybe if you're going on long haul camping trips or something. I don't know. But yeah, no, that seems like a long time. But those Yeti coolers can do that.
Yeah. Like I mean, I think it's nice. There's
they keep the heat
things
up so well.
I remember when I go camping, I like to pre-prep food, like real food, not just sandwiches, although we do eat those too. And it is, you know, that safety factor to know that your chicken is not sitting and getting warm randomly in a plastic cooler.
That's fair. Okay. All right. So final verdict on it. Good, but pricey.
Yes. As are most things in this world.
Well, no. You go to dollar store, everything there is.
But is it good?
No, but exactly. It's cheap.
Good equals pricey.
That is true. Generally speaking. Sometimes you can get fleeced on some stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
But that does happen from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes you pay for like a brand name or maybe, you know, like because it's got something fancy with it, like natural, you know, or something like that. Like if it's food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one tomato comes from this farm, one tomato comes from Walmart. And you're like, oh, I'm going to pay 50 cents more for the one that came from the farm.
Absolutely.
There you go. All right. Moving into Coeur d'Alene Post Falls Press headlines. But first, initial success or total failure. Mad Bomber Brewing Company, located at 9265 North Government Way in Hayden, Idaho, is a veteran-owned and operated business that has been serving North Idaho since 2013. Swing by the brewery to try the freshly tapped Tripwire Red, a beer with perfect combination of full flavor and light body. Be sure to check out their special events throughout the week, including trivia on Mondays, all-day happy hour on Tuesdays, open mic night on Wednesdays, discounted growler fills on Thursdays, and live music on Fridays and Saturdays. Mad Bomber Brewing also offers a wide selection of ciders from North Idaho Cider for those who may not want beer. Located near Triple Play, come by and mention the podcast when you order to receive $1 off your first beer. Mad Bomber Brewing, recklessly brewed in Hayden, Idaho.
Nice.
Not bad. We should time that one too, because that one's a little longer. You gotta breathe. All right, I'm doing good. Wednesday, August 11th, headlines. Madison, what we got?
We have traffic jams. If you can't beat them, move them. This one is mine, Madison Hardy.
It's a good headline. Good job.
Thank you. Growth on the Rathdrum Prairie and within Highway 41 corridor is projected to increase traffic volumes by 64% by 2035. Despite this, no projects have been planned within the city of Rathdrum to accommodate impending transportation demands, City Administrator Leon Deuce said. Instead, Deuce said officials are looking at diverting through traffic away from the area through road signs on Highway 41. There are arguably three main congestion areas in Rathdrum: Highway 41, Highway 53, and the BNSF rail tracks. By taking a beeline on Lancaster Road, drivers can reach US 95 and connect to Highway 53 through Greensbury Road, avoiding all three obstacles, Deuce explained. Many drivers face all three congested areas when traveling through Rathdrum by heading north on Highway 41 and crossing the tracks at Mill Street to connect to Highway 53. On paper, it sounds quick and easy, but the frequency of trains in the city of Rathdrum, as residents know all too well, can contribute tremendously to commute times. Du said that trains come through here regularly, probably 2 or 3 trains per hour. The BNSF Railroad cuts right through Mill Street to the refueling station a couple miles west. When the rail crossing signal is activated, Deuce estimates about 2 cars can fit across the divide and connect to Highway 53, which causes safety concerns for travelers. He said a lot of accidents happen when people are not paying attention or getting backed up on the tracks. Probably 4 years ago, a camper on the back of a truck stopped and the trailer was on the edge of the tracks. A train came by and took off the back of the trailer. Idaho Transportation Department and Rathdrum officials discussed possible projects nearly 2 decades ago to diminish the at-grade crossing impacts at Mill Street, ITD spokeswoman Megan Gann said. At-grade crossings are railroads and highways running at the same ground level, a Kootenai Metropolitan Planning Organization Executive Director Glenn Miles said. Miles told me that agencies like removing at-grade rail crossings because the chance of trains hitting someone, which is a pretty traumatic event, decreases substantially. It takes about 2 miles for someone driving a train to stop, and on that stretch of highway, they're probably going about 40 or 50 miles per hour. It's not easy to stop a train when someone jumps the tracks. However, Dew said the project never came to fruition because of environmental and financial issues. So they will continue to now rely on signs to divert anyone going to Rathdrum outside of Rathdrum.
Hmm. Okay. I mean, follow the signs, I guess.
Yeah. You know, when we posted this story, a lot of people were upset because obviously US 95 already has quite a bit of traffic. If anyone's driven it recently, Greens Ferry Road also has quite a bit of traffic. So it's not like they're just redistributing the problem.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, hopefully it does something positive, but at the same time, I don't know.
Here we are.
All right. What else we got?
We got crossing boundaries to fight fires. This one is also mine, Madison Hardy. A bill introduced by U.S. Senator Jim Risch from Idaho could streamline North Idaho wildfire management projects. Officials say are often hamstrung by interagency restrictions. Over the years, Idaho Department of Lands Policy and Communications Chief Scott Phillips said the agency has seen important forest health projects become unnecessarily delayed by the National Environmental Policy Act. The Firesheds Act, proposed by Risch and Representative Blake Moore from Utah, would circumvent these barriers by creating a joint agreement between governors and federal departments to accelerate wildfire management initiatives. Phillips explained that across the country, notably in North Idaho, those initiatives are curtailed by the intermixing of state, federal, and private-owned forest lands. Phillips said that knowing that wildfires know no boundaries helps prevent catastrophic problems in the future. Measures like Firesheds Act take into account that we need landscape treatment on forest lands across boundaries regardless of ownership. Phillips believes the Firesheds Act would build on the work underway in the Idaho Shared Stewardship Program, a partnership between state and federal organizations to address forest health in target areas. Phillips said that shared stewardship often occurs in areas where timber is located, and some of the best and most productive timber areas are in the Northern Priority Landscape. In that Northern Priority Landscape, there are about 2 million acres that are regularly assessed and identified for treatment. The Idaho Panhandle National Forest is currently in the final stages of planning the Scattered Lands Project, which spokesman Patrick Lair said is a direct result of the shared stewardship effort. Idaho State Forester Craig Foss said scattered lands got its name because often you'll see a large block of ownership everybody identifies as national forest, but there are U.S. Forest Service state endowment, private non-industrial, and private industrial properties all intermixed. As an employee of the state, Foss said that he can identify a treatment needed in a place of endowment land and have it approved within months. However, the same process can take several years on the U.S. Forest Service lands. Even then, Foss said the interagency collaborations restricts projects' abilities and can lead to litigation, which he expressed to me several projects have happened, and one being proposed in 2005 that is still not forward at all.
I mean, if it's going to help the wildfires, or help put out the wildfires, not help the wildfires, we don't want to help the wildfires, if it's going to help, you know, put some of that down.
Yeah, you know, it still has to go through both the Senate and the House, but we'll see what happens.
Yep, we'll get there. All right, moving on to Thursday, August 12th headlines. Dire need for more police officers. This is by Bill Bewley. A downtown business owner is calling on the Coeur d'Alene City Council to budget for more police officers in the downtown area. Quote, I have been in business downtown for over 14 years now, and I can say that over the last year and a half, I have seen a very marked change, wrote David Pullis, Coeur d'Alene resident and owner of the Moose Lounge at 4th and Sherman. Quote, I personally believe it is related to COVID and the emotional toll business closure and mask mandates have taken, but whatever is happening is real and it is not good. He added that, quote, just the sheer fact that we have more people living in the area should be enough to recognize that more officers are necessary. More people means more problems. It is as simple as that. The council will be considering a $109 million budget when it holds a public hearing on September 7th. That includes two additional full-time full-time police officers at $213,696 and one sergeant at $133,095. The budget also calls for one grant-funded police officer at $106,848. Police Chief Lee White said Wednesday the city could use more police officers. The downtown area at times has demanded more attention from police. Bars have been very busy all summer, and even late at night. Quote, there is a dire need for them, White said. The city has 71 police officer positions, with two currently open and another opening soon. Boy, that sounds like a lot, but... quote, I know that you're all looking at the budget right now, Pulis wrote to the council. I encourage you to add the officers necessary and take some pressure off the officers we have now that are dealing with the bad apples in our barrel. You're going to have to add officers when you get more people. I mean, that's just kind of... simple logic with it.
Mm-hmm. And I think this does connect to a series of stories that we ran earlier in the year about issues downtown. You know, there are tons of people. Obviously, we're a tourist community, and there have been more issues growing in crime rates and specific crimes in the downtown area. So I guess this would hopefully, if anything does happen, address that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and then we're going to Friday, August 13th. Protesters oppose vaccine mandates for medical field. This one's also by Bill Buley. About 200 people rallied against forced vaccines for medical professionals on Thursday outside Kootenai Health. People waving signs and flags stood on all four corners at US 95 and Ironwood Drive for about 2 hours. Many passerbys honked and waved in support. Jennifer Pinero, a nurse from Spokane, was among them. She said she believed a mandated COVID-19 vaccine for workers in the healthcare field would be a violation of their rights. She said they worked through the pandemic in the past year and they didn't need a vaccine. Now many hospitals nationwide are requiring staff to get vaccinated or lose their jobs. Pinero hopes that that doesn't happen in this region. She wonders how healthcare workers went from being praised for bravery standing on the front line against the virus to having their jobs threatened if they don't get vaccinated. Pinero said, I want to support all nurses. We're all in the same situation. As she stood on the shoulder of US 95, holding an American flag in one hand and a sign in the other that read, last year's heroes, this year's unemployed. Pinero said, we survived the pandemic without vaccines using our personal protective equipment. We did it right. We're all very well trained on how to do it right. We didn't get sick. We helped everybody else who was sick. Joy Gibson, an in-home care nurse, held a sign that read, no forced COVID vaccine. She said she was taking a stand for those who don't want the vaccine. Gibson said, I believe in medical freedom. Nearly 1,500 hospitals, roughly a quarter of all hospitals in the U.S., now require staffers to get a COVID vaccine, said Colin Milligan, a spokesman for the American Hospital Association. Kootenai Health provided a statement that said it, quote, strongly encourages employees to be vaccinated, but vaccination is not mandatory. Serena Cogburn, a CNA, took part in the rally. She said that she has doubts about the vaccine and doesn't want to be forced to take it to keep her job. Quote, I don't want to lose my job, so I'm standing for my rights. If I don't stand for them, I'm not going to have any.
Oh boy, what an issue. What a complicated, dividing issue, unfortunately.
Yeah, you know, I don't work in the healthcare field. I completely respect them for all they've been doing in the last 2 years. Basically, and I just hope that there is some resolve.
I had a conversation actually with Josh about this a couple of days ago, and we were talking about, you know, because the idea now it's the medical freedom, you know, like my choice. I want to get it if I don't, and I can see that side of it. I absolutely do. I'm certainly not here thinking that they should be that people should be forced to get it if they don't want it, especially people who. It would make them more sick. I understand that there's some, you know, rare cases in that event as well. But at the same time, I don't know, it definitely goes up against another belief that I have that businesses should be able to, you know, unless it breaks a law, pretty much they have the right to do what they want with their business. And if you don't like it, I mean, that's kind of the world we live in almost, you know, I mean, it's same thing as, you know, a drug test or wearing, you know, socks and shoes or a uniform or something like that. Like a business should be able to do what a business wants to do. Now, and I draw the line on that with like, because, oh, well, what if the government? Well, I think the government's a different issue. I think if the government mandates something, that's totally different. And that should be probably discussed and debated. And probably I would probably lean on the opposite side of that kind of thing. But as much as I am totally for people being able to do what they want with their own bodies, at the same time, a business should also have the right to be able to do whatever they want with their business. So if Kootenai Health ever did something, it doesn't sound like they are, but if Kootenai Health ever did something like that, I mean, that's their prerogative. Mm-hmm. So it, but it is a complicated issue. Like where, you know, where does a business rights begin and where does an employee's end? It's a complicated issue for sure. And while I have my own opinion on it, I don't think it's necessary. I'm certainly not an expert by any means.
Absolutely,
I don't have all the answers.
No, I don't have all the answers. I don't think anyone has all the
answers. No, and honestly, this might be a situation where there is no right answer. Because at the end of the day, you know, it'd be perfect if everybody could and would get the vaccine. But I totally respect people's right if they don't want to, or if they have medical issues as well. But again, going back to, you know, especially a healthcare provider, I think that that might even, you know, knock it up a few notches more for me, that they have that moral responsibility to make sure that everybody is safe and healthy and not spreading the virus, especially to people who are sick as well. So I guess I was just all over the place on that, but
I think I understand, and I hope our listeners understand too. Yeah. You know, it's been a difficult issue. I think one thing that I found very difficult to grapple with, and I'm sure other people have as well, is to watch something that is a scientific issue become so hotly debated. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been reading this book recently that talks about just the way that different fad diets has been linked through to different healthcare measures in the industry. You know, how it started off with being like low fat or like high fat.
Was that the Atkins diet?
You know, it's actually like the Keys study is what I'm talking about.
Okay.
But
well, no, like the diet you were talking about, mm-hmm. like the one. Yeah, it was that. I'm not familiar with all
so
of them,
it's so. Like the high fat diet will lead to heart disease or something like that. Gotcha. That's like one of the things that they're talking about, or will lead high fat leads to high cholesterol, which leads to heart disease.
Right.
And these are things that was hotly debated and still is hotly debated decades later. Mm-hmm. And as time went on, scientists would pick one side or the other, and they developed a sense of selective bias.
Mm.
So people are regenerating these ideas, and people go into scientific studies or go into research with a specific mindset or an end result in mind that they're hoping to achieve. And that can really distort things.
Sure.
And so I think, you know, for anyone that's a listener out there that's kind of trying to grapple with this issue themselves, just keep researching, keep listening and trying to understand things. I think that's the best thing that we can do, is to be an educated society.
Sure.
And that can form your own basis of opinion and decide what's best for you and your family.
Absolutely. I'm definitely a facts and figures guy, and I try to tune out all the noise and opinions on that. And I think, did you see the press release from Brad Little yesterday? Mm-hmm. I thought that was very succinct, and I felt that was good. And all of the stats that they put in there, 98.9% of new COVID-19 cases since January 1st were people not vaccinated. 98.6% of COVID-19 hospitalizations since January 1st were not vaccinated. I mean, these numbers speak for themselves. Like, I don't, your rights are your rights. Absolutely. I'm not going to do that. But I said it on the last podcast, I think vaccines work. They're proven that they work. I don't think that's a controversial thing to say. There's reasons why we don't talk about people getting the Black Plague or polio anymore. It's just, I'd be more than happy to talk about a person's medical rights and meet middle halfway on that. Absolutely. But talking about how vaccines don't, that's just ridiculous. Sorry. Stats don't lie. Stats don't lie.
All right, we're going to change gears here. Local lawyer makes case for AG. This one's mine, Madison Hardy. Idaho Attorney General candidate Art McComber believes it's time to be aggressive and push Idaho values forward. Times are changing, McComber said in a sit-down interview Thursday with the press. McComber said, the focus would be much more aggressive under my administration because I think it needs to be. McComber, who will appear on the Republican primary ballot next May, said, more aggressive about protecting the rights of people, fending off the federal power, and making sure Idaho values are pushed forward in the narrative. We have to be outward looking. We have to be more aggressive. That's what I plan to do. For the past 15 years, McComber has practiced law in Coeur d'Alene, argued 5 cases before the Idaho Supreme Court, and taught at North Idaho College and Gonzaga University School of Law. If elected, McComber said three things would take precedence. One, quote, push back on the federal powers so it doesn't overreach and get into our business as the state of Idaho. Two, quote, stabilize the office and make it responsive to the needs of Idaho today. And three, quote, protect Idaho values. What prompted McComber's candidacy was his disappointment at the lack of AG involvement during the COVID-19 pandemic. Specifically, McComber felt the AG office should have issued a public response to Governor Brad Little's use of emergency powers when closing businesses and enforcing lockdown measures. McComber said, I think it's because Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin believes that the state of Idaho means the government of Idaho. The problem is, as an elected official, I think that definition has to include the people in the state of Idaho. In his opinion, McComber said it would have been, quote, a lot more rational and helpful if the AG issued and published a statement to educate citizens on the full extent of those powers. McComber said, quote, there's an awful lot of political anger that's been generated that could have been avoided by just treating the people in the state of Idaho like the rational and reasonable people that they are.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Gives me anxiety because we're coming up on election season. It's always a fun time for us.
Yes, as the, quote, politics reporter mm-hmm. for the Coeur d'Alene Press, yeah. It's going to be a lovely year.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, jumping over to Shoshone News Press headlines for August 13th. As we've been doing before, we'll start off with some wildfire updates real quick, starting with the Character Complex fire that's burning near Pritchard and north of Kellogg. The two main fires that are burning in that complex are the Deceitful Fire, that is at 7,224 acres burned and 15% contained. Firefighters continue to focus on building direct and indirect lines to increase containment. On Thursday, crews more tightly secured the area west of Beaver Creek, where ignition operations occurred on Tuesday. The structure crew removed sprinklers from the Cedar Creek area, which is a positive indication of progress. Fire personnel continue to patrol the Character Ridge and anticipate that the area being secure enough to remove hose lays in the near future. Fire personnel continue to patrol the Graham Creek area, and other crews will continue the mission of securing the 933 road. The fire is actually going up to the Coeur d'Alene River Road as well, which is... be interesting to see. I think there's still some closures up there, but that would be interesting. The fire is going to get right up to the river. Also, the Pritchard fire, that was 1,342 acres. That is 100% contained. Crews are on top of that one. So not too bad, but it's still kicking up smoke, obviously, if you're in the area. Jumping down south, we've got the State Line Complex fires. The major ones in that are the Tumbledown Fire, 9,301 acres burned, 20% contained. Engines and heavy equipment continue to make headway and build direct and indirect fire lines. Chipping operations will continue along the Quartz Creek Road. There is scattered heat in both the Bluff Creek and Nugget Creek drainages. Mop-up tactics will start on the south of Blackjack Road. Firefighters continue to monitor, hold, and secure contained sections of fire line. The other larger fire is the Dolly Creek Fire. That's 854 acres and 81% contained. And containment on that fire is expected within the week. So good news on the fire front. I don't know if today and tomorrow's massive heat wave is going to help the situation, but it sounds like they've at least got a handle on things moving forward. All right, now we'll jump into Shoshone News Press headlines. Headline, area schools approaching start dates cautiously. This is by Josh McDonald. Josh went in and spoke with the superintendents with all three school districts in the Silver Valley. That would be Kellogg, Wallace, and Mullen. You can go in here and check out the story for yourself if you're interested in all the stuff they're going to do when coming back. But in short, I'll sum it up that all three, Kellogg, Wallace, and Mullen will not be requiring masks, but social distancing and personal hygiene will be stressed, and they also recommend everybody to get the vaccine. So if that changes, we will let you know and go from there. Also on the front page of the August 13th edition, we've got an interesting kind of sparks flying story. Smelterville SCSO relationship comes to an end. This is also by Josh McDonald. The contractual relationship between the city of Smelterville and the Shoshone County Sheriff's Office has come to an end after the city officials declined to renew their deal with SCSO. The city had been paying SCSO $1,750 a month for a guaranteed 80 hours a month of coverage and patrol since they negotiated the hourly amount in 2017. This 80 hours was additional time that deputies were to spend in the city and would not count toward the hours they spent responding to crimes in progress. Following a city council meeting on Wednesday, Smelterville Mayor Tom Benson spoke to the news press and expressed his displeasure with what he believed to be a subpar effort on behalf of SCSO, quote, We were no longer happy with the service we were getting, and it's been going on for a long, long time, Benson said. Sheriff Mike Gunderson was caught off guard by Benson's statements due largely to the fact that when he called and asked city officials if there was any issues, he said that they told him no. One of the largest complaints Benson said has been that the hourly requirement of patrol hours wasn't being met, but Gunderson said that in the last year they've averaged more than double the contractual amount of 80 hours each month. He added that the level of service that they were providing Smelterville is coming to them at an incredibly discounted price point. Quote, $20,000 per year for a $150,000 service is a pretty good deal, Gunderson said. From August of last year to now, we've averaged 168 hours per month of patrol hours inside Smelterville. At that rate, when you factor in the hourly cost of paying a deputy being roughly $42 per hour, you're looking at almost $7,100 per month in just wages. That's counting vehicle maintenance, fuel, and other related expenses. Benson also discussed some disdain with how the patrolling deputies spent their time inside the city limits, especially when it came to where they were when they were in town. Quote, there are certain areas of town that really need attention, and they're not giving them the attention I think that they need, Benson said. When I ask, they tell me that they need more hours, but I see them sitting down here at the end of the town by the coffee stand where there is no activity. They sit there for hours and hours and hours, and we get billed for those hours. There's no activity, but there's great cell service. Oh, shots fired, Mayor Benson. Gunderson addressed these comments directly in an interview with the news press, citing crime prevention techniques like simple visibility as a variable reason for them to sit near the intersection of Airport Road and Main Street. Quote, of the 101 arrests we've made in Smelterville in the 12 months, 31 of them came directly off of Main Street, Gunderson said. People don't see us there 24 hours a day, so they just think that they don't ever see us. But that isn't anywhere we can be for 24 hours a day. Gunderson also highlighted some frustrations over broken promises between his office and Smelterville that may have played a part in souring some of the relationship. Quote, when we signed our agreement a few years ago, they promised us that if they could have any extra money, it would go toward the sheriff's office, Gunderson recalled. But then we hear that they have money for a code enforcement officer. Do they need a code enforcement officer? Yes, I think it's something they need, but I also think that we made a dent in some of their problems too. Along with 101 arrests in the last 12 months, Gunderson said his department responded to 850 calls, made 293 traffic stops, and patrolled the city for 2,000 hours, not counting the time associated with any of the paperwork for the previously listed incidents. According to Mayor Benson, when he recently spoke with Gunderson, he was informed that the SASO would not be responding to anything that wasn't an active crime inside the city limits. This means no enforcement of infractions, code violations, or ordinances, including blights. The story goes on for a little more. As somebody who currently resides in Smelterville, blights are definitely an issue in the area, and I just hope that the city gets some sort of law enforcement back. That would be great. We'll just leave it at that.
A little nervous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just slightly. It's, you know, Smelterville's got its spots, as does every town. All right, moving north to the Bonner County Daily Bee out of Sandpoint, Wednesday, August 11th headlines.
LPOSD updates COVID-19 guidelines. This one's by Emily Von Sant. Lake Pondere School District is opening up schools as they detailed in their COVID-19 school guidelines for this fall. Last year, when a student tested positive for COVID, a district policy called for them to stay home for 10 days, and the school would do contact tracing of individuals that may then be at risk, and those individuals would also have to isolate at home. This fall, the school board is changing their tune. LPOSD Superintendent Tom Albertson said, "We aim for the fewest disruptions of education as possible." This year, if a student tests positive for COVID, Albertson said they will have to isolate at home for 10 days. After that, he or she can return to school if they are fever-free for 24 hours without the use of medication. If there is an exposure to COVID-19 in the household, then after the positive person's last exposure date of 10 days, the person that lives with them must quarantine at home for 10 days as well. During the time of isolation, the individual cannot attend school, nor can they participate in school activities. But if a student does test positive for COVID-19 or any other illness and has to isolate, only that person with direct responsibility for the care of the student will be informed. Basically, from the story, is that only the person now will have to be isolated. No one else. No contact tracing. Hmm. So more kids can stay in school?
That's not a bad thing. In fact, it's a very good thing.
It's a very good thing.
Mm-hmm. Moving on. Human trafficking isn't what you think it is. This is by Emily Bonsant. Human trafficking isn't what most people think it is, said Aaron Weem, a licensed clinical social worker and practicing therapist. The International Labor Organization estimates that 21 million people globally are victims of human trafficking crimes. Those crimes, ILO defined, are ones that exploits men, women, and children for sex or forced labor through molestation, harassment, or drugs. Not all trafficking is drug-related, and it is not what the media has made it out to be, said Peggy Fry, a director for the Lilybrook Family Justice Center, said. Quote, we are seeing human trafficking in a lot of different factors. The media mostly shows kidnapped kids from a mall piled into a van, said Fry. Trafficking is usually on a smaller scale. Traffickers may kidnap youths, but the real and present danger is online, area officials said. In some trafficking situations, a person in, quote, active addiction will do sexual acts in exchange for controlled substances. In other cases, victims believe that their trafficker is in love with them. Fry said this kind of trafficking is going on locally. Quote, trafficking in Bonner County has been going on for some time now, especially drugs in exchange for pictures, sexual acts, or the promise of sexual acts, said Fry. Weem, who said trafficking is psychological enslavement, said she has engaged with many clients that did not know they had been trafficked until they sought out help. Weem has led Sandpoint's July 30th World Day Against Human Trafficking, an educational event and prayer walk, for 2 years. Quote, awareness is undervalued, she said. There is a quote by D.H. Lawrence, what the eye doesn't see and the mind doesn't know doesn't exist. If we can't see what is happening, how can we stop it? It's like, if a tree falls in the forest, no one's around to see it.
Did it really fall?
Did it really fall?
Did it make a noise?
Exactly. It all comes down to education on human trafficking and the warning signs, then teaching your knowledge to others, Fry and Weem said. If you see something, say something, and report it to the local police and Lilybrook Family Justice Center. Quote, to parents, I can't stress this enough. Monitor your children's contacts and social media, who they are talking to, and who they are with. I mean, good advice.
Yep, it's true. I remember when I was in elementary school, I believe, there came in with a how to make an email so it doesn't look like you're young, or, usernames so that it doesn't alert people of your age. Because, if you do I love playing soccer and bananas for your Gmail, it does look like a small child's email. But if you do, like, or if even if you did Madison Hardy 2000, it's like, oh, was she born in 2000? That means she's this age. So it was an interesting discussion.
Were you given school emails?
In high school, yes, but okay. They meant like personal emails.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. I was like, wow, I'm super old.
All right. Thursday, August 12th, wastewater plant needs updates. This one's by Emily Von Sant. The city's wastewater treatment plant is in much need of updating. Next year, the city is planning to spend $5 million to get the wastewater treatment plant project magic management started, Jennifer Stapleton, city administrator, said. Excuse me. This current plant was built in 1955 from components purchased from the Farragut Naval Station, said Stapleton. Today, over 60 years later, the primary clarifiers from the original plant are still in use. The typical planned life of a wastewater treatment plant is 20 years. This makes Sandpoint's plant beyond the useful lifespan. In May 2017, the city and its consulting engineers began developing a new 20-year facility plan. Other than the current treatment plant's age, Sandpoint was built on poor drainage soil. So when there's a high level of precipitation, the groundwater levels rise quickly and then flows into the city's wastewater collection structure through cracks and holes rather than the stormwater system, officials said. Officials said on the website that when experiencing high levels of inflow and infiltration into our system, we exceed the peak flows of the city of Coeur d'Alene's plant, which is serving a population of over 50,000. Even our typical wet weather flows are the same as the peak flows experienced by cities of Post Falls and Rathdrum combined. Sandpoint's wastewater goes through the wastewater distribution system to the treatment plant before it is discharged into the Ponderay River. Treatment of wastewater reduces the amount of pollutants that are discharged back into the environment, city officials said.
I should hope so.
Gosh, I know. Well, the Sandpoint officials said on the city's website that the reduction of the amount of pollutants discharged into the Ponderay River is of the utmost importance and critical health of the river and anyone downstream that uses the water. The total projected cost for the updated wastewater treatment plant is between $50 and $70 million. If the budget plans for fiscal year 2022 pass, then the city plans to finish the updates on the wastewater treatment plant by 2027.
Hmm. All right.
Well, I sincerely hope it passes.
Yeah, me too. That sounds like a
big concern.
Could be a shitty situation. Ah. That's our one cuss word for the day. I hope you weren't going to use it.
I'll use it when we stop recording.
Okay, moving on. Sandpoint's add new patrol officer. This is by Emily Bonsant. The city is looking to add a new police officer in the next fiscal year's budget. Growth in the area has created a need for a new full-time patrol officer, Jennifer Stapleton, city administrator, told Sandpoint City Council. Each week, the city administrator, mayor, and city council receive a weekly activity summary from the city police. Quote, the number of incidents and impacts show a new officer is needed. In the past 12 to 15 months, calls for police service are up substantially for the past year, said Stapleton. Typically, the city would see police calls ebb and flow with the tourist population with peaks from July to August, Stapleton said. However, calls for service have been holding steady at summer peak levels for more than 6 months. Call reports last year averaged 50 to 60 pages a day. Now the daily report averages 70 pages. The increase of calls is due to population growth and the rise of tourism, said Sandpoint Police Chief Corey Kuhn. Quote, calls vary from family disputes, intoxication, noise complaints, and more. Calls are for assistance and or police presence. Not all calls are crime related. Calls for service have been up the past 10 years. Stapleton said some of the calls stemmed from the pandemic. The city is applying for grants to pay for the new position for the next 2 to 3 years before the city takes on the full cost. If the grant is not received, then the public safety funds will be allocated to replacing police vehicles, said Stapleton.
Everyone needs more police.
Sounds like we need more cops. That's what I'm hearing. That's what I'm getting. I'm getting the feedback here. I'm getting the feeling that more cops are needed.
Somebody call 911. We need more cops. All right.
You thought my pun was bad. Uh-huh. All right. Friday, August 13th headlines.
All right. Trestle Creek complex fire activity increases. This one's by Carolyn Lobsinger. Rising temperatures and lower humidity are expected to cause an increase in fire activity on the Trestle Creek complex, fire officials said Thursday. The fire, which has burned over 4,000 acres, is at 0% containment still. All fires in the complex, which were sparked by a July 7th lightning storm, have been contained with the exception of the Trestle 6 until a windstorm earlier this month pushed the fire around the others in the complex, nullifying previous containment. Wednesday's heat saw an increase in fire behavior and strong southwest winds, reaching 20 miles per hour on a sustained level. In the evening, further increased activity, Jess Harvey, public information officer for the Incident Management Team 3, said. Harvey said, we currently have crews working above the Trout Creek Road, just below the west side of the Ridge Fire. Aircraft have been providing water drops to fires in the southwest and other priority areas to help slow growth. We're continuing to build a fire break line along the westernmost side of the Ridge Fire. Crews are closely monitoring that and engaging wherever possible, Harvey said. With the rough and steep terrain where the fire is located, a direct attack remains unattainable with the resources currently assigned to the fire. Harvey said, therefore, crews are mainly using heavy equipment to construct a contingency line along the south and west sides of the fire and engines to directly attack where possible. At the request of fire officials, all homes in the current ready evacuation status were moved to set status early Thursday afternoon. The change in status was prompted by a forecast calling for shifting winds, creating potential for fire movement into those communities. Residents can go online to fire.airnow.gov to get the most up-to-date information on smoke levels in their area.
Fire's bad. Put them out.
My heart breaks for the Churchill Creek area.
Yeah, they've been dealing with a lot.
It's been a month.
It's been a long time. They've been dealing with that for quite a while now. Hopefully things work out. All right, moving even further north to the Bonners Ferry Herald headlines for August 12th. NBFD dealing with burn piles purchases new vehicle. This is by Victor Corral Martinez. On August 7th, around 5 p.m., North Bench Fire District was informed by dispatch of a report of several slash piles burning in the area of Songbird Lane. North Bench responded with Brush 161 and Chief 100 vehicles to investigate. Upon arrival, they quickly discovered three separate slash piles and one active burn barrel. According to the news release, crews quickly contained and mopped up all the four fires. They dug a fire line around all four burn areas and called the fires controlled. The district reminded residents to keep Idaho green by not burning their slash or debris piles immediately after a brief rainstorm moved through the area. Quote, even though we have had cooler temperatures lately, our fire danger is still extreme and our fuels are very dry. I'm sorry, I'm not done with the story yet, but really? Really? Like, slash piles are just not... in, if you're having a fire or something like that, this is totally different. Like it under normal, not so dry circumstances. But I've just never wrapped my, as somebody who's from here, I've never wrapped my head around burning garbage. I just don't like, go to the dump. Like it's just, I don't. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox. That's not a thing. Soapbox.
Off your soup can.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Additionally, North Bench required a new vehicle, part of three new apparatuses ready and in service to respond to calls. Quote, it's because of our great community and all their support to our agency that we were able to purchase these vehicles. North Idaho Coalition also contributed to North Bench by donating time and helping to install the decals needed for the vehicle. Well, at least they got some new rigs. Stop burning things.
More problems, more rigs.
I
All right. O'Brien faces controlled substance charges. This one's by Victor Corral Martinez. Philip O'Brien, 32, is scheduled to be sentenced on August 18th after pleading guilty to possession of a controlled substance with the intent to manufacture or deliver. O'Brien faces a felony conviction and possible term of life imprisonment, a fine of $25,000, or both. First District Judge Barbara Buchanan will preside over the case. The charges originate from an October 18, 2020 routine traffic stop with Bonners Ferry Police Sergeant Willie Cowell and Boundary County's Sheriff Deputy Alan Schleif with the Idaho State Police Trooper Mike Martinez. Collaborative effort. According to court records, O'Brien was at the Cooney River Inn parking lot where he spotted by Cowell, who testified that he was aware of an active arrest warrant out in Cooney County. Cowell testified that he requested a narcotics canine unit respond to the scene because of O'Brien's previous narcotics-related charges. The canine quickly alerted law enforcement to the odor of a controlled substance coming from the truck. A truck search revealed an ounce of methamphetamine in a magnetized plastic container, later positively tested as methamphetamine. No other drugs or paraphernalia were found in the vehicle. Two cell phones were found in the car, were checked for evidence of drug activity following a search warrant. According to court documents, after O'Brien was read his Miranda rights, he allegedly said that to take the methamphetamine to an unknown person on U.S. Highway 2 near the Montana border. He also told police that it was his third drug run, Cal testified. O'Brien also faces an unrelated charge in Bonner County for malicious injury to property. In addition, he is scheduled to appear before a jury on October 18th in a charge of driving without privileges and battery charges in Kootenai County. He has pled not guilty to all those charges. This man is wanted in every panhandle county.
It's almost impressive. Yeah, I guess stop doing drugs. Don't light things on fire. That's the message for today. On the show,
that is the message for today and every day.
And every day, really, really. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's
fire, drugs, bad.
Both are very bad. Don't do those things without prescriptions or supervision, or I guess it's a few job. I guess there are some jobs
where this is where we find caveats into the rules.
I know, because that's our job. That's our job. We're supposed to
poke holes.
Yes, exactly. Okay, is that it? Are we done?
Yeah, I've been done with you for a while, though.
That's totally fair. It's totally understandable. I get it. I don't blame you at all.
One day I think you're going to get sad. I'm so sorry.
No, I'm actually, that's all good. It's just a facade.
For a positive note, everyone, last week Chance called me his friend, so we are actually friends. So.
We are now. It's official. I don't know. It's been a long road. Getting from there to here. It's been a long road. What? Come on, Star Trek Enterprise reference. That's totally off your radar. But there is one listener out there that's like, all right, Chance is a Trekkie. Did not know that, but there you go.
I grew up watching Star Trek.
What?
Yes.
Did we just become best friends?
I thought we were best friends last week.
Well, if we weren't, then we are now. We have to talk about more Star Trek on the show. All right. To wrap it up, once again, we'd like to thank Hecla Mining Company for sponsoring this episode. To learn more about Hecla Mining Company, please visit heclamining.com. Thanks again for listening, everybody. We really appreciate it. Please like, comment, and share all of our stuff on social media. If you're interested in the stories we talked about today or the ones we did not, check us out at www.quarterlanepress.com, shoshonnewspress.com, bonnercountydailybee.com, or thebonnersferryherald.com. If you listen to us on a podcatcher of any kind, such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, Google Podcasts, Amazon Podcasts, Stitcher, Player FM, all of those. Please like, subscribe, or follow us, whichever one is appropriate in your case, so you can get every single episode as soon as it comes out, and you don't have to stream it. You can just download it over Wi-Fi, and it won't count toward your stuff, because some of us don't have unlimited plans. I don't have a limit. I had to drop my limited plan. It's expensive. It's cheaper to just connect a bum off of people's Wi-Fi. Just kidding. I have Wi-Fi. Guess everybody's going to think that I live in a van down by the river.
But you do.
Nowadays, it seems like everybody's adopting that lifestyle.
All right. I think our listeners have had enough.
I think they're done. We need to get out of here.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.